Good evening, folks. This is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Treewell. Tonight, we're going to be discussing a significant figure and a fascinating character from the 1800s, a man named John Murray Spear, and his attempt with his followers to create a mechanical body for God to inhabit, a literal electric Christ. So that's going to be quite a ride. I have to provide sufficient background. This may end up being a two-part episode, but that's fine. There's a ton of fascinating material about John Murray Spear. And I've been able to do some real research on this for the past, actually been off and on with it for a couple of years, and just he's a fascinating, fascinating person. And his most famous or infamous experiment, which he did not perceive as an experiment, but rather a mission from God, but a mission delivered by the spirits of, including but not limited to, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. Well, you just have to hear it to really believe it. This is facts. These are facts. These are things that happened. He's actually quite well documented, and I'll, you know, provide some references. But this is a story I would hazard to say is unlike any other. Certainly unlike any other I've ever heard. Born in 1804 and dying in 1887, John Murray Spear's life covers almost the entire 19th century, and he was deeply involved in many of the causes that were hugely important during that century. I mention that he was born in 1804 and actually looked into making sure of the documentation of this. There's records of his birth and of his christening. He was born into the Universalist Church, and it's documented where and when he was born, which was in Boston, and christened in the First Universalist Church. I mention that in part because a lot of his views, for a little bit there, almost made him seem like a time traveler. He was a man vastly ahead of his time in many, many ways. And I think it's worth to mention that. But no, he was not a time traveler. He was born in 1804. After spending some time as a shoemaker, he began to train for the ministry in the Universalist Church. The Universalist Church, which still exists today in the form of the Unitarian Universalists, was and at that time it was somewhat different because the Unitarians and Universalists eventually merged. But without going into an entire side episode on that, they were a Christian denomination that believed that everyone would ultimately go to heaven. Everyone would eventually be reconciled with God. And that was very different than almost every other denomination of Christianity, which tends to believe in an eternal hell, eternal damnation, lake of fire, forever and ever, that type of thing. The Universalists did not, and that set them apart, and they were very progressive even at that time, and were a rather hotbed for progressive causes, the largest of which, the most important and the one that caused the most conflict, and I mean that in a good way, they were very much a hub for abolitionists. and John Murray Spear became deeply involved in the abolitionist cause for many years. Ordained in 1830, John Murray Spear spent the bulk of the next 20 years as a Universalist minister and pastor. However, a lot of his time also went to social justice causes, where he had highly progressive views, especially for that time. As I mentioned, he was an abolitionist. He was actually part of the Underground Railroad. He, at times, risked his physical safety and even life for assisting people held in slavery to freedom. Other causes that he championed and was highly active in were prison reform, the abolition of the death penalty, women's rights, and labor rights. So he's very much a person well ahead of his time. He was an activist, and sometimes to the detriment of his ministerial duties, and sometimes to the detriment of his family. He was one of those people who is very important in efforts to change the world, but not always so good at keeping food on the table. And that's not a slam. He was a very serious and dedicated activist in a number of very good causes, but not always so practically attached to responsibilities that he had. And that left him often in dire financial straits and caused problems for his wife and kids. Again, not the issue we're really going to deal with here tonight, but just kind of to paint the picture. His entire life changed with an event that took place in 1844. There are differing sources and differing reports about what exactly happened, other than of the background of what happened. He was at some sort of public meeting, which may have been an abolitionist meeting, or may have been a free speech meeting in which he defended the right of speakers to criticize the Catholic Church. Considering what a hotbed of abolitionist activity Boston was, and considering how Irish Catholic Boston was then and continues to be, maybe it was my perception is it was more likely that when he was defending people's right to criticize the Catholic Church, that he ran afoul of some people who became violent, and he ended up getting beaten up and received a concussion and spent some time in a coma. And that became a true turning point in his life. In our time, John Murray Spear's experience while comatose would probably be considered a near-death experience, an NDE. He had interactions with entities and received what he felt were predictions of the future. His experience was not taken seriously by those around him, but it had a tremendous effect on his life. He had visions, he had premonitions while unconscious, and came back, and after that became, while still continuing to be an activist and a minister, also became a spiritual seeker. And in the late 1840s, he became involved with a man named Andrew Jackson Davis, also known as the, not from New York, I may mess up the name, the Poughkeepsie Seer, a guy about 20 years younger than Speer, who was of very poor background, but rose to prominence as a hypnotist, what was then called mesmerism or animal magnetism, which is a fascinating topic that we could go off in that direction another time, a healer, and a receiver of spiritual messages, and a Swedenborgianist, a follower of the theologian and philosopher and religious leader Swedenborg, and clearly a forerunner of what would become spiritualism. And Speer, up here for a second, read a book by Davis and wrote a lengthy and very positive review thereof, of what Davis asserted was a channeled work. And they eventually met and interacted. And Speer was significantly influenced by Andrew Jackson Davis. At this time, so Speer writes the review of Jackson's book in 1847. In 1848, the Fox sisters begin having interactions with a spirit that purports to be that of a dead person, and the spiritualist movement, that's usually when it's formally dated to begin. And not long after its beginning, Speer's daughter converts to spiritualism and begins to persuade her father, along with Andrew Jackson Davis, who's also telling him to be more open to the spirits, to get involved with spiritualism. And not just in a philosophical way, but in a literal, experiential way, to open up to receiving communications from the spirit world. And Speer does. So I'd like to just kind of pause here for a second to tie together, to a degree, all of the threads that are going on involving John Murray Speer in the late 1840s, early 1850s. He's wearing several different hats. He's a universalist minister. He's heavily involved in the abolition of slavery movement, also heavily involved in jail and prison reform. He is credited by many as the originator of the idea of probation and parole as an alternative to just throwing everybody in a cage and then laying them out when so much time has passed. He has been described as a prototype of a functioning parole officer before there was such a title, where in lieu of incarceration as an alternative, he would watch over people who had been convicted of violating the law. I say that in part to highlight that he was a social reformer, but also to get across that John Murray Speer wasn't just a flake. He wasn't some person who comes out of nowhere and says, yeah, God told me to do this and that, and, you know, the spaceship leaves at midnight. He was a very established figure and a very respected figure in his time. Also, he was not a grifter.
There's never been any indication that any of the stuff he did was ever for profit. Any of the stuff that he proposed, quite the opposite. He was usually running low on money. So anyway, John Murray Spears doing those works. And he's also getting involved with Andrew Jackson Davis, who may or may not have been a grifter, and may not have been, may have been a complete prodigy, a experiencer. I do not pass judgment on what he was or was not. And right about the same time, in 1848, the Fox sisters begin hearing their knocks, and the entire spiritualist, both with a capital S as the spiritualist church religious movement, quickly begins, not as a direct result, but heavily influenced by things involving the Fox sisters, and also all of the cultural things surrounding the visitations that the Fox sisters alleged they were receiving. And I don't want to detour too hard into the Fox sisters right now, because that's gone back and forth and is the topic of multiple books. And they may have been for real. They may have been grifters. They, in my own personal perception, were probably some of both. They experienced something, but the pressure to perform on demand often leads to fakery and grifting. But spiritualism is poised to explode right about this time. And John Murray Spear is getting more and more involved with it. And at the same time, to keep all of the subplots going here, in 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act is passed, and the entire national confrontation that was going on about slavery ratchets up a large notch, because now the Fugitive Slave Act essentially makes slavery national. Instead of merely being, still an atrocity, but an atrocity mostly confined to the South, the Fugitive Slave Act makes all of America required to return escaped slaves to slavery in the South. And that becomes federal law, and that ignites the fuse that leads to the Civil War. John Murray Spear was highly active in opposing the Fugitive Slave Act and in assisting escapees in the Underground Railroad of getting away, and was part of an organization involved with that in Boston, which was a real hub of both slavery abolition and active resistance, and particularly active resistance to the Fugitive Slave Act. So all of this is happening at the same time. Also, and this I can't stress enough, we live in an era where science and religion are completely different fields. I was tempted to say planets. There's a huge and deep separation between anything scientific and anything religious. In John Murray Spear's time, there was roughly no divide. The idea that religion's over here, and they believe what they believe, and actual science is over here, and they believe what they believe, is non-existent in that time. And so the spiritualists believed that they could be both a science and a religion. If that sounds familiar, it was certainly not the. It is certainly not a unique thought, a unique concept of the some union between science and religion. It was a concept that, among many others, Aleister Crowley talked about. It's something that spiritualists still talk about today, those remaining spiritualists that are active now. But it's also been a kind of a trope for many organizations that are all of the board of somehow uniting science and religion. Well, this is a time where they haven't divorced yet. Science and religion are not really opposing each other at this point in time. And that just should be borne in mind when looking at some of the things that are going to come later. But also just some of the things that have already happened. That, for example, Andrew Jackson Davis has written a book that he says is channeled material, and is channeled material from Emanuel Swedenborg and also from an ancient Greek physician. But it claims to be scientific. Now, some critics at the time tore apart the science, and I don't know, maybe they were right, but just it was a very different world, and science and religion were not opposite poles at this point in American or world history. So in 1851, Speer has his first face-to-face meeting with Andrew Jackson Davis. And Davis encourages him to open himself up to direct contact with spirits, which, from everything that I've been able to determine, were believed to be completely or nearly completely the spirits of departed human beings. The spirits of the dead. And Andrew Jackson Davis heavily encourages Speer in 1851 to make himself open to receiving messages and to some extent becoming a vehicle for them. In 1852, Speer becomes even more involved with spiritualist meetings, and his daughter has converted to spiritualism, and her name is Serafina. I may be messing that up a little bit, but Serafina is how I would pronounce it. And she has full-on converted to spiritualism at this point in time, which has taken off to being a significant religious movement by 1852. In 1852, Speer makes his first statements that are channeled. He makes a series of 12 statements conveying messages from the spirit of John Murray, who he is named after, who was a founding Universalist minister who had since died. And John Murray Speer, speaking messages from the spirit of John Murray, has them published as Messages from the Superior State. And this brings up the point of accepting the identity of spirits that they purport versus who they might actually, who or what they might actually be. There was a broad trend in spiritualism at this time to accept that whatever a spirit said, that's who they were. Like there was some universal no-lying rule or something. I don't tend to take that very seriously. I'd be blunt, I think that's a very risky and bad idea. It is one that continues to this day. And if you're familiar with any of the shows where people go around and bother ghosts, you can clearly see what I'm talking about. Just because an entity says that it's a coal miner that died in 1895 in a saloon fight, and there was a guy who died in 1895 in a saloon fight who was a coal miner, doesn't mean that's who you're talking to. And this becomes important a little bit later in our story. But one of, in my opinion, for what it's worth, the gaping problems with the spiritualist movement of that era, and it has continued into the ghost hunting movement of our era, ghost hunting activity of our era, is blindly accepting what non-human entities say as their identity without testing anything, without, most of all, just put that on a shelf. Take it for what it's worth, but there is no way I would recommend anybody accept that at face value. But accepting what they're saying at face value was the way things were done then. And when an entity claiming to be the late clergyman who had baptized him, claiming to be John Murray, appears or speaks to John Murray's spear, he does not question it. And he delivers the alleged John Murray material without a hint of suspicion. So then, in 1852, John Murray Spear delivers his first channel material. The next year, 1853, he begins to work with and for a group of spirits referred to as the Association of Beneficence, a committee of deceased famous people that include Presidents John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, as well as Benjamin Franklin, and other luminaries at that time. And they have a extensive series of reforms they'd like to make in society, and some fantastical inventions that they wish to impart to humanity. And he works with this group, and particularly with a subset of this group called the Electricizers, for a period of time. And in 1854, we really get to the weird part. Under the direction of the spirits, John Murray Spear, who would be the first to admit that he had no formal training in anything mechanical or electric or really scientific at all, would develop a new type of machine, what was called the new motor or the new motive power. And it would be, just to, I'll be very blunt, it would be an electric Christ. It would be a body for the Spirit of God to live in. And it would be fully alive. And while robotic or mechanical, would be imbued with the Spirit of God and would send out energy that would have supremely practical uses all over the earth. It would end the need for human labor and allow people to move to a higher level where they did not have to work to live. And it would be self-replicating,
It would be in all senses a machine, but also in all senses alive. And it would be a vehicle and an embodiment, an incarnation of Almighty God. So yes, that's what they were going to build. And this was a very literal physical device. This wasn't a metaphor. This wasn't some other parable, anything like that. This was a literal, actual machine, which the spirits that were speaking with John Murray Spear were extremely specific in every detail of how this was to be built. And it was to take a 9-month period, similar to the 9-month development of a child, and then it would come into the world and be the electric Christ. And John Murray Spear and his followers took this extremely seriously and began to construct this object. I think we should just pause here for a second and ask ourselves, what was going on with John Murray Spear at this point? This does not, to me, appear to be schizophrenia, which he was quite beyond the age where that usually onsets, nor any other discernible mental illness that I have been able to find in doing some research. He seems to have been in contact with beings, with entities, who were leading him on this path that he was told would lead to building an electric Christ. Spoiler alert, it doesn't work out that way. But I think we should go into some details of how it does work. But first ask yourself, what was he actually experiencing? Because it very clearly seems to me to be something beyond himself, not just his own delusions. He was an eminently practical man in many ways. And until having something like a near-death experience, at minimum, he had no outside contacts of a supernatural, paranormal nature. And then, having sought those out under the counsel of Andrew Jackson Davis, he seems to be being led by actual, intelligent, but non-physical entities. So let's just ponder that for a second, and then we'll get into the details of what this machine that they started making was. For a 9-month period, John Murray Spear went into daily trances, drawing detailed designs of every aspect of the soon-to-be machine. In 1854, the construction of the greatest spiritual revelation of the age began at High Rock Cottage in Lynn, Massachusetts. Lynn, Massachusetts is an interesting location for this episode to take place, for reasons I will explain momentarily. Robert Damon Schneck, writing about this very subject, described Lynn, Massachusetts as having a history that is pure Lovecraft, full of witchcraft, sea serpents, spontaneous human combustion, and rioting Quakers. So what better place to conduct such an operation? Yes, it kind of speaks for itself. The Practical Spiritualist newspaper, The New Era, detailed the construction of what it called the electrical infant that may,
claiming the device had correspondence with the human body. The machine consisted, as it describes, a black walnut table with insulated legs, topped by a series of copper, zinc, iron, and magnetic plates. From there, two magnetized struts rose from either side, suspending magnetized balls on copper chains between them. Later descriptions include details such as hair-like antenna to produce etheric power and metal plate lungs that would rustle as a symbolic form of respiration. In all, Spear and his followers are believed to have spent $2,000 on its construction, which would be more than $50,000 in today's money.
The sheer weirdness of what Spear was up to caught the attention of other spiritualists, including his former, one might say, mentor, or at least friend and guide into spiritualism, Andrew Jackson Davis, who decided to visit him and see what was going on. Davis was appalled. Describing what he had seen in the Spiritual Telegraph that June, Davis emphasized the practical spiritualists' enthusiasm for their project, stating that for them, each wire is as precious, sacred as a spiritual nerve. He believed that the new motor was genuinely inspired and supernatural in origin, but he also left with the impression that something had gone very wrong. Davis, who himself had told Spear to work with the spirits, worried that Spear had gone mad. In Davis's description, Spear suffered from the terrible misfortune of being easily imposed upon by his own impulses. He mistakes them, at least two-thirds of the time, for impressions from higher intelligences. So, was this all in Spear's head, or was this where the spirits are leading him? Obviously, we will never know. But they continue to construct this body, a mechanical, electrical, robotic body, to receive the Spirit of God. And soon another development occurs. Sarah Newton, the wife of Alonzo Newton, both serious Spear followers, members of the Practical Spiritualists movement. Sarah Newton, after several visions, came to the belief that she was the Mary to this mechanical Jesus, and that she needed to go through the process similar to pregnancy to deliver the new Messiah into the world. Newton began living in the High Rock Cottage Laboratory full time in order to maintain an umbilical link with the device. There, John Murray Spear and company made daily efforts to charge the machine and infuse it with life, with some evidence suggesting that these exercises may have been sexual. Eventually, Sarah Newton went into what she described as labor. After 2 hours writhing in pain, she reached out and touched the new motive power. Its inner rotor is said to have started moving for a moment, but the promised self-perpetuating motion did not occur. Although members of the group took temporary movements as a sign of success, Andrew Jackson Davis was skeptical. The supposed virgin birth, he said, was just the power of suggestion and superstition. Nonetheless, Spear's followers defended their project and wrote a rebuttal to Andrew Jackson Davis's account. Spear's collaborator, Simon Hewitt, said the motor was still gestating. Would it not be wiser to wait a little and witness its growth rather than to attempt the strangulation of the infant? He wrote.
The criticism from Andrew Jackson Davis hit the John Murray Spear movement quite hard, and they became pariahs even within spiritualism, as well as a subject of significant public mockery. The great P.T. Barnum mocked the idea of a woman becoming pregnant by a machine, saying that if things like this are going to happen, the ladies will be afraid to sleep alone in the home if so much as a sewing machine or apple corer be about. The entire project had become something of a laughingstock. The local support was burned out, and Spear moved the machine to Randolph, New York, hoping to utilize the area's superior magnetic energies for their experiments. The new motive energy was taken apart for transport and at once reassembled at its new home. Efforts to animate it increased, but events went the opposite direction. One night, a group of local youth broke into the Practical Spiritualist compound, tore out the machine's copper heart, and threw the new motor into the electric mill pond in pieces. At least that was what John Murray Spear said happened. In the November 1854 Scientific American, the analysis was a bit different. We do not believe a word respecting a mob breaking into the building and destroying the spiritual machine. We are of the opinion that it was broken by the crafty author of it, whose schemes have come to the exact point of exposing his ridiculous pretensions. Despite what looked like a failure to anyone else, Spear and his followers declared a spiritual victory. Sir Newton's husband, Alonzo, wrote in The Educator, a spiritualist publication, that the machine was a model for the embodiment of the idea. That is a little too philosophical for me to argue. But the idea that they were going to create a physical, mechanical Christ had been pretty solidly disproved. Whatever happened or didn't happen to the machine's pieces. In doing research for this episode, came upon some apparent evidence that the machine had been found and located rather recently in the last couple of years. I have to say with some regret that that article is fictional. That if you Google parts of this, you'll find pictures of a very well-made machine, but having personally researched that avenue, that is a prop made by a very talented artist who does TV and movie props, and the story behind it is fictional. I don't want to mention the names because I don't want to violate anybody's confidentiality, and I don't want to send anybody down a wrong path. But the machine is lost to time. And there we are. The project ultimately ended in failure. And there was no electric Christ. Recovering rather quickly from the whole mechanical electrical Christ debacle, John Murray Spear continued a rather radical path of progressivism, led by the same group of spirits, and in 1857 began to advocate free love as a way to regenerate society. He advocated for the end of institutionally sanctioned marriage, and the replacement with free association by mutual desire and consent. He championed the availability of birth control and women's right to refuse sex, even with their husband. These ideas were considered radical at the time and separated him from whatever spiritualists were still dealing with him. He lived out his free love ideas with women's rights advocate Caroline Hinckley, and they had a child in 1859, which was a huge public scandal. And in 1863, Speer divorced his wife of 32 years, Betsy, and married Hinckley. They saw fit to move to England for the next 6 years then, giving lectures, holding seances, performing healings, but did not gain much ground in radical politics. Speer and his new wife returned to America and lived in San Francisco until 1873, then in Philadelphia, constantly in activism in highly progressive causes. They helped organize Virginia Woodhull's Equal Rights Party and worked for women's rights, health reform, and social justice. After 2 decades as general agent for the Congress of Spirits, in 1872, John Murray Speer indicated that he had received a message instructing him to retire. Later in his career, he admitted that his missions had not always been promotive of immediate union and peace, and subjected him to trials born mostly in the secret chambers of my soul. Still, he expressed general satisfaction with how he had lived his life. Dearly have I loved the work in which I was engaged. I have been helped to see that beyond the clouds that were round about me, there was a living, guiding, intelligent, beneficent purpose, the elevation, regeneration, and redemption of the inhabitants of the earth. John Murray Speer died in Philadelphia in 1887 and was buried in the Mount Moriah Cemetery. He had an absolutely fascinating life, and much of it, in fact, the most controversial, interesting parts, which last about 20 years, were all directed by non-human entities. And in the end, he was, as so many others, left hanging, promised the moon and the stars, and then left standing around like the people in When Prophecy Fails, or numerous, or the Millerites, or numerous other people that over and over have been led by spirits, ended up being led really nowhere. And that should raise a lot of questions. What were these entities? What were their real purpose? What was this all for or about in the first place? Was there ever the faintest real possibility of some sort of machine that was in it, let alone an electric Christ, but there was any sort of functional mechanical device with a spiritual nature? Or was this all trickster? Was this all folly? Was this all putting humans on and running them around in circles and then just sort of letting it all go? This is hardly a unique. It's unique in the details, but it's not at all unique in the overall story arc of a person who is contacted by spirits, given a great mission, and then when he or she goes forth to carry it out, it ends up being just a road to nowhere. It reminds me very much of a quote from John Keel. It's on page 187 of my copy, soft cover copy of the Mothman Prophecies, in the chapter Games Non-People Play. And Gill says, "Again and again, psychics and contactees have gathered their family and friends together to sit on a hilltop and wait for the predicted end of the world. This charade has been repeated many times in the past 25 years with UFO contactees preparing for the wonderful space people to descend in their flying saucers and evacuate a chosen few from our doomed planet." And he goes on to elaborate on numerous examples, past, present, and continuing to our time, of the same game being played over and over. And he just questions, what is the point of this? There are centuries of revelations of the end of this world and the coming of the next, and yet it never pans out. And that seems to be exactly what happened with John Murray Spear. A brilliant man, a dedicated humanitarian in many ways, and a person who was led through a labyrinth by spirits and ultimately left high and dry and abandoned and standing waiting for something to happen that never happened. And that went a number of times for him. What are we to make of it? I don't have any great snappy answers of what it means or why this happens, but I guess I would just advise anyone getting involved with non-human entities to really be careful with what you listen to. And I would do more research than you do conversation. But, you know, that's my opinion. In any event, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for putting up with me talking about one of my favorite topics, John Murray Spear and the Electric Christ. I'm Vincent Trewell. This is The Weird Part. Thanks for listening, and good night.